Okay, welcome back everybody. Welcome to the final session, and a very intriguing one it's promising to be. We've got Professor Joe Melling from the University of Exeter, who will speak in a minute or so on the subject of dressing and redressing the patient, mental health of patients in clothing, 1850s to 1950s. Joe Melling, as I've said, works at Exeter. His interests in terms of research covers labour history, including the history of masculinity and management in the workplace, but also the history of health and illness at work. And I'd just like to kind of draw attention to one of the most recent publications, and that's an edited volume together with Priscellas on the subject of dangerous trade, histories of industrial hazard across a globalising world, which came out with Temple University Press in 2012. And we're looking forward very much to your paper now. Thanks.
Thank you, Daniel. Thank you to Vika and Nicole for inviting me. It's been a great experience. Lovely room. I thought of various explanations of taking coal to Newcastle and so on, or madness to Newcastle, but didn't really work. But I am delighted to be here, and I'll be talking about mainly mental health patients in the century from the 1850s to the 1950s. All the research of this paper is carried out jointly with Nicole Bauer, my co-researcher and co-writer, and a much earlier version of the paper will come out, I think, in textile history in a few months. Well, let me begin by saying, in a celebrated discussion of schizophrenia, the famous psychiatrist Ronald D. Lang, or anti-psychiatrist as he sometimes is known, noted the place of clothing in relationships and quarrels between patients and families. One woman believing that a child had been killed wearing her clothes, though she was unclear whether the child had been murdered by herself or her mother. Lang speculated that those who have an insecure knowledge of the world camouflage themselves in various ways, including in the use of clothing. Now, one recent study of nurses has found that nurses in mental hospitals and with mental patients treat people differently, and acknowledge they do, according to the clothes they wear. So we can see that contemporary observations of the importance of clothing in mental health require sensitive handling. Now, most historical research on clothing and health, as we have seen today, have been concerned with the hazards attendant on their manufacture, the dangers of infection from clothing and the parasites that live upon them, rather than the making and the wearing of garments within institutions. However, I'm concerned today with a particular kind of institution and the way clothing was used in the design and the maintenance of that institutional regime. But I would also suggest that it's a mistake to overdraw the boundaries between the workplace and institutional life in the 19th and 20th century. For these establishments, and I'm talking about lunatic asylums which were built in every county and every borough of the country, in addition to hundreds of private and fee-paying establishments, these large establishments often house more than 1,000 patients, hundreds of staff, and they were centres of production as well as centres of consumption. As I hope to show, clothing formed an integral part of asylum life. The making, the alteration, repair, cleaning and disposal of garments occupied a significant element in the household economy of these great hospitals. More than this, clothing formed a key part in the political and moral economy of these organisations, reflecting changing concerns over the priorities of the institution and the way they were being managed. Now, I begin with an outline of what I will say, and I want to briefly talk about clothes as text and coded transcripts, and I want to emphasize their role in transactions within the institution. Secondly, I'll look briefly at institutions, how you got into a mental an asylum or mental health hospital, and what role clothing played in gaining access. Then I'll come on to look at the economy of the hospital, the costs, the pressures on people, and especially on space. And then raise a question of reforms in the 20th century. What kind of impact did they have on patient life, and what were their origins? I hope to leave open conclusions. In fact, the whole paper is an open invitation to discussion. As I said, the research is based on a database of two different counties, well over 9,000 patients assembled in many different, as you can see, many different levels of relational database. So I'm more than happy to talk numbers and examples if you wish, but today I'll be mainly talking about qualitative experience. Nicole Bauer is the heroic field worker, rather than me, who did much of this. So I'm going to begin with an item of clothing. The jacket. It belonged to Agnes. She was a mental patient in Saxony. The jacket dates from about 1895. That means that she was about 50 when the jacket was made, though Agnes herself was diagnosed with dementia praecox, dementia of the young, or schizophrenia. She spent 25 years in a mental institution. As a skilled seamstress, or sempstress, she actually remade the jacket from a piece of institutional clothing, not only to fit her slender figure, but embroidered on it are the details of her life history. The words emblazoned on the asylum dress were punctuated with the laundry number 583, doubling both as a piece of patient identification and as a laundry number. The narrative continued on the inner lining of the garment, and it was interpolated and coded rather than transparent. It was written, her narrative, in German Gothic script, and offered clues to her personal history. However, while the embroidered voice we see here talked back to the institution, it did so in a peculiar way, refashioning patient identity in a tapestry of words and numbers. Now, the vivid address offers a vivid illustration, we believe, of the agency of individual patients, their capacity for protecting as well as projecting their inner thoughts in a closely observed world of the mental institution. Now, we argue in this presentation that the rules governing clothing and the responses to dress in different hospitals not only involved the physical fabric of the garments themselves, but also embodied the clothing, something of the conflicting or competing narratives of asylum life. The idea that has informed much of our research is that clothing can be understood as a social and cultural transaction, which literally figured in the identification of the person's place within a given order. And we argue that the scope for personal expression depended on space, personal space, as well as cultural space. Now, we're familiar from a whole host of writing, Irving Goffman, Michel Foucault, and so on, to look at institutions as essentially a set of disciplined and disciplinary boundaries, places where the regimen of the institution is imprinted on the soul of the individual, and rehabilitation comes through the ability of the individual to learn how to police themselves, to return to normalcy from abnormalcy, to be called back from insanity to sanity by governing the soul. And transgression of these boundaries in the form of dress, in the institution or outside, carried the risk of sanctions and penalties. Now, we can also say, by looking at institutions and dress, the way patients are dressed is also the way in which the institution dressed itself, and has also defined a nexus between that institution and the wider world. The case of Millicent B and Annie, I'll talk about in a minute. Let me talk about Millicent for a moment. Millicent was admitted to Womford House Asylum in 1873. Her admission documents say she was an unmarried gentlewoman. I can talk about that. It's a common phrase. Not doesn't mean gentry. And the documentation laid particular evidence on her insanity, the proof being, and I quote, her skin was filthy, her dress was neglected, and she had three stockings on. These were given as key facts of insanity. Female dress, in particular, frequently formed part of the portraits of the insane provided in medical notes, drawn from an initial certification of insanity by local doctors. When Annie B. arrived at Womford House in November 1884, she had been an inmate of Bethlehem House in London before being transferred elsewhere for several years. Her appearance again forms a significant feature of the description of her as a wayward woman. And we see here, on admission, she's been erotic, destructive and careless of her dress, very fond of fancy work. They appear to have lessened their tendencies, but in 1883 she is reported to be full of delusions, among which the principal is that she is Christ. Annie had actually been residing in a seaside town and had shocked the residents by promenading up and down the seafront with her New Testament, including personal diagrams of New Jerusalem in which she figured. She was proclaiming herself as Jesus Christ, but her destructive tendency was demonstrated in their misuse and disregard of their clothing. So around the dress of females, and particularly unmarried females, were woven different shades of interpretation about mental condition. The ways in which religious delusion, as well as erotic and destructive tendencies, were expressed in attire and demeanour which would scandalise the public. The clothes of men and willful destruction of their dress attracted less attention in provincial asylums during the 19th century, though the dirty and dishevelled appearance of the male lunatic was noted. It tended to be masculine behaviour and conduct that was more likely to provoke comment. Loss of male reason was therefore exhibited in an incapacity to fulfil duties, in particular in employment and in public life, by misconduct or violent assault. The reimposition of strict dress codes and strict decorum in clothing was again less prominent in accounts of male rehabilitation than female rehabilitation. So clothing is a key sign or signal of mental state as far as 19th century doctors and institutions are concerned. They signify a state or lack of normality. And in particular, I'd like to draw your attention to the meaning, the double meaning of words used at the time, both by doctors and by relatives, friends, and contemporaries of the insane. And these words in particular, the words dirty and filthy, doubling both as a description of a physical condition, but also as a description of mental habits and personal conduct. Now, I've talked about the relationship between the person and space, and I think one of the key features I want to underline today is the relationship between identity and personal space, as well as personal dress. And within the institution, I think control over space was key to the transactions between the patients, the staff, and the institutions that we want to draw out, the access to personal space. For example, a nightshirt or nightgown may be simply bed attire, but if the patient is dressed in nightgowns all day, they are being held in a particular dependent relationship to the institution and to its staff. And their ability to enter spaces also depended on dress and attire. Access to the airing courts of the asylum, which were a key part of the asylum. Men who would go labouring on the farm of the asylum. Most asylums, big asylums, had farms. Again, they were fitted and dressed for it. Now, this personal space is, I think, being noted again and again by psychiatrists. To quote just one source, Russell Barton, very famous reforming psychiatrist of the 1950s, he actually identifies a key area of reform needed in the 1950s, which was large numbers of patients have no place in which to keep personal possessions, no lockers by their bed, mainly because of overcrowding, I might add, but keeping in a single property room is a bad system. It's never available. Clothes are issued to a ward, there may be no guarantee that the same patient can keep the same item of clothes, same frock. So for the reformer, Russell Barton, in the 1950s, personal clothing and personal space go together, and they are key to recognising modern medical ideas of the dignity of the patient, the dignity of the individual. And Barton goes on to stress things that patient appearances, including clothes, stockings, shoes, hairstyles, are all part of the culture of the institution, because if other patients see a lack of care, his idea is they will become demoralised, nothing matters. So for the good of patients, he's again restating the case that appropriate, careful use of dress and personal appearance is needed for patient morale. So whilst he's a reformer, he's again restating the case for appropriate dress. Now, I've noted already, in terms of coming to the asylum, the role of clothing. And despite what might be obvious, that you can see what patients are wearing, the actual recovery of the history of patient clothing is very difficult. That which was so visible to contemporaries is strangely hidden from historians. With the exception of photographs inserted in early patient files unevenly, hospital records reveal very little about the garments that patients use. Distinctive clothing for patients was certainly designed, made and issued for different work tasks by inmates. If you were cleaning, washing, farming, gardening, laundering, scrubbing, you all were given specific clothing. It was part of a fixed matrix of clothing within the institution. Patients' own clothes was usually taken from them, and they were given a set of clothes. However, it's important not to exaggerate the closure of the institution or the clothing of the institution. The extent to which patients were compelled to wear institutional clothing is strangely unclear. Even in the great poor law asylums in the 19th century, it appears that only those patients who were considered to be high risk and at risk of harm were issued with particular kinds of clothing, including restraining jackets, strait jackets, and so on. Even in public asylums, such as poor law asylums, it doesn't appear, there was certainly no kind of resemblance to prison clothing with darts on it, anything like that. It tended to be local clothing of a strangely basic kind, and I can go on and talk about that, why that is so, but the fact is, attendants were prosecuted and disciplined for stealing this clothing to wear themselves outside the institution. It could be for labouring and so on. Even less so was institutional clothing a feature of fee-paying establishments, which were clearly the institutions used by the lower middle classes and the middle classes. Fee-paying establishments were originally philanthropic institutions. Later on, they charged fees. I mentioned the prevalence of dirty habits. And this phrase, dirty habits, is used to denote dirty and disruptive individuals who were dirty outside the asylum, but often they were simply used to denote elderly patients who sold their own clothing. But they could also be used, these phrases, about negligence and disregard of dress within the asylum. One female was described as untidy, loose, because she had her hair unpinned within the institution. Leaving a garment unbuttoned was again seen as a pretty significant omission. The language of dirt, therefore, is not restricted to the description of filthy, soiled or ragged clothing, but it also indicated a material or emotional threat to the order of the institution, of which clothing was seen as one part. I'll give you one quote from the late 19th century, 1886, Digby Fields. And here, the concern was that the poor law, which was providing some of the worst, most hopeless cases, were delivering people in a poor condition, dirty, and in the wrong kind of clothing. In fact, some women, in one of the most scandalous cases, were delivered in a way the superintendent described as almost nude, almost naked, in a clothes wagon. And so Digby Asylum specified, the poor law relieving officer shall be required to bring and then take away the clothing of the patient. Once admitted to the asylum, almost all patients we know, I'm talking about poor law asylums, were issued with standard clean clothing rather than marked garments or uniforms. Relatives sometimes attempted to suggest that the wearing of personal clothing would speed the recovery of family members, but the institutional rules were usually quite firm that there was an equality, a democracy of sameness within the institution. One patient who escaped, it was also a way of identifying patients who left the institution. That was an important function. Not distinctive, but recognisable. One patient who left the institution, and as you probably know, if you keep outside the institution for a few weeks, you cannot then be reinserted unless you're re-examined. But one person who went missing for 6 months was found hanging in a local tree and recognised only by the institutional clothing. So again, in some ways, the institutional clothing functioned to make people recognisable. However, already by the 1870s, some medical authorities outside were campaigning for improved clothing, for clothing that resembled external clothing, the Lancet in the 1870s. Now, what I want to do is just briefly say something about the political and moral economy and the place of clothing within the asylums. Many of the people who came to the asylum has worked in the clothing industry. We've heard about the West Country being a centre of the textile industry. Males who had been engaged in tailoring, shoemaking, mat making, laundry work were admitted from the 1840s, as well as handicraft work. Many of the women who came, in fact, domestic service is by far the largest number of women coming to the asylum, but many of the women came actually had some background, certainly in domestic work. The County Asylum of Exminster, that's County Asylum Devon, by the end of the 19th century, we think 8,000 items of clothing were being washed every week within the asylum itself. So the laundry facility was simply enormous. Most of the hands in the laundry were female, though male patients took the heavy manual work of mangle turning in the laundry and the washing machines. Women actually washed the clothes, men did the heavy preparatory labour. By 1945, the same laundry served the needs of 1,500 patients and was staffed by 13 paid employees and a very large group of patients by 1945. And it was assessed a few years later that the same laundry handled 27,000 articles of clothing per week. So it's an absolutely enormous labour. And at that time, the 50s, 81 workers are working there, 65 of whom are patients. So what we're actually saying is that it's an enormous place of labour, and the most usual work for a woman to be given was a job in the laundry or the housekeeping work, and that was seen as essential to her recovery. I'm moving on now to 20th century and how things changed in the 20th century. I don't know where I am with the... Yes, here we are. There's a DCLA laundry, 27,000 articles. So I'm going to now just talk briefly about the 20th century as compared to the late 19th century and whether things changed in patient clothing. By the 1950s, there was a noticeable difference in styles of dress, and patients were allowed to vary their personal appearance to make choices about clothing. We can trace the beginnings of the reform and relaxation in patient clothing really from the early 20th century. Before making big assumptions about the asylum's determination to impose the same standard on all patients, we have to remember that clothing and clothing bills represented a rising proportion of asylum budgets from the 1880s. Clothing became a significant item in mental hospital budgets, including the cost of making, repairing, adjusting, and cleaning clothes. The main engines of reform were three. First of all, legislation and the Board of Control, which inspected all asylums. Secondly, medical doctors and medical opinion, which argued for liberalisation. And thirdly, the growing diversity in the background and aspirations of the patients coming to the institution. One turning point was the passage of the Mental Treatment Act of 1930. The Mental Treatment Act is very important because it introduced for the first time the category of voluntary patient. And thereafter, most patients coming to mental hospitals in notion were voluntary rather than compulsory certified. So 1930 is an important. And by 1935, we noticed in Digby Hospital, I cheated here, I'm afraid, the bottom picture is not the laundry, but the mortuary. But I thought, well, they won't know. they won't be able to tell us. Oh, I can see that's quite a small building for laundry, isn't it? Anyway, that is the mortuary. But the patients on both sides are tightly dressed. We're aware that there's still a stock of all the types of women's clothing, standard women's clothing. We're glad to find the garments of a more modern style in conformity with the outsider being introduced. So that is the Board of Control. And also, the efforts to modernise clothing should be seen in the light that 1930 meant for the first time a significant number of white-collar workers, male and female, began to come to public asylums. Before that, the stigma of the poor law was usually too great. So the entry of white-collar workers is part of the story. Also, by the 1920s, it's noticed that male nightshirts, as well as female gowns, nightgowns, were marked with the names of wearers. At least the Board of Control wanted this minority practice to spread. They recommended that patients should be allowed to reclaim the same nightshirt from the laundry after being cleaned. In 1922, the Lancet is pushing for better asylum clothing, more, and I quote, individuality and normality in clothing. Whereas in the 19th century, the idea was sameness was therapeutic. By the early 20th century, the idea is individuality is therapeutic in terms of clothing. And one key factor in what we think of as a reform of the 20th century is the arrival of military patients. Already in the First World War, military patients were in fact given distinctive and quite attractive dress. I'll give you an idealised picture. You have a highly idealised, almost pre-Raphaelite picture of wounded servicemen in the First World War. But all military personnel, both during and after the war, whether they be physical patients or mental patients, were given good quality hospital uniforms, which were also military uniforms. The presence of patients in receipt of an award of a pension from the Ministry of Pensions and the issue of pensions ministry clothing hasn't been given the attention it deserves in the transformation of institutional clothing. The emphasis was upon, I don't know if I've got any more. Already by 1920, it's noticed the men have two lounge suits, personal underclothing of good quality, all are provided with overcoats, nightshirts and toothbrushes. So military personnel in the poor law asylums have an important, we think, improving effect. By the Second World War, a definite reform movement is coming. The Devon County Asylum notes patients are allowed, 1945, to retain their own clothing where this is found to be clean and suitable if they or their relatives so desire. So the reform movement is clearly underway. However, the shortage of space remains a problem. 1938, there's a movement from the Board of Control again to begin to introduce individual lockers and solutions. And the nearest we have in Digby is the introduction of an experimental clothes rack at the end of the bed. I could give you a picture, but essentially the overcrowding becomes so difficult that the beds are stacked quite close together and there's no space for a locker, and even though individual patients claim that their items are being stolen, etc., etc., and their relatives, there's no real improvement really until the 1950s. I'm keeping well on time, leaving plenty of space for... I really want to look at the question of why things changed in the 20th century. Critical surveys of large mental hospitals in the 1950s and 60s often present a bleak, unchanging world of conformity and discipline. Irving Goffman's famous studies of institutional hospitals and so on, Michel Foucault's contemporary accounts, Robert Zatz, a whole series of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. The 1950s and 60s are an indictment of these institutions for sameness, where the fabric of the regulatory regime imposes itself on the individual, driven by concerns well beyond the personal needs of the patient. However, this critical assault on the institutions in the 1950s and 60s, which led to the great so-called decarceration, deinstitutionalization movement, has obscured significant changes between the mid-19th and the late 20th century. We now have a more careful assessment of the pressures on these institutions and the benefits as well as the costs that they presented. It is true that patients were seen primarily for much of this period as members of a closed community, distinct from the wider world, directed by those in authority without their active consent. As the machinery of the great laundry system indicates, individual identity and possession were seen as impractical for many years. Patient lockers were an unnecessary gift of personal space. Only gradually was choice rather than sameness recognised as the instrument of recovery. But to understand the origins and the scope of such reforms, clothing can be understood in transactional terms as well as the means by which patients and people define the relationship between the institution, the resident and wider society. A whole range of people, we now think, are involved in the asylum, if not in its everyday affairs. To essentially get presented to a doctor, it was almost invariably the relative or friend of the patient who presented them as unwell. If you're unmarried, you're much more likely to present them as unwell than if you're married. But if you live alone, you've got less chance of getting into the institution than if you live as a single, solitary, unmarried person with a family. So to avoid getting in the institution, live on your own. But such transactions were not simply a matter of common sense or consent. Transactions between people in the institution and within the institution register struggles for rights and also the intrusion of progressive opinion from without. The portraits of patients from photographs of the early 20th century provide a narrative on the way in which people were addressed as well as dressed. Admission to these places signal a descent into mental illness from the neglect, soiling or destruction of clothing. So the concern in the Victorian year is for conformity, tidiness and appropriate dress. Therefore, asylum clothing is made of robust material durable to weather any encounters with the insane as well as the weather. External pressure led to a shift in thinking during the 20th century, even though a concern with good order and economy persists throughout the century. Clothing formed one weapon in the battery of mechanical restraint, straight dresses and the clothes or textile cell. But also more subtle means of punishment and exclusion could be used by making a patient dress in their nightdress all day. So we can see from the evidence of the Southwest, the Devon evidence and so on, that the agency of patients does exist within a matrix of the institution. But we think the main agents for transformation of dress came from legislation, the medical profession, and a host of people assembled around the patients, though the patients themselves did figure in that story. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for a very